Welcome to section 1 in reproduction. In this section, we will do a quick overview of the male anatomy and discuss male reproductive physiology, including spermatogenesis and erectile dysfunction. So let's get started. So briefly talking about the male anatomy, we're going to talk about the urinary pathway and then the ejaculation pathway. So with the urinary pathway, we have the ureters bilaterally, which enter the bladder. And then from there, we have the prostatic urethra, and central, there's just one prostatic urethra, and then it goes through the membranous urethra and the penile urethra. Now for the ejaculation pathway, we have seminiferous tubules, and those are in each testicle, and then the sperm then goes through the epididymis, and then the ductus or vas deferens, again bilaterally from each testicle, and then the ejaculatory duct enters in to the ductus deferens. And finally, we have the prostatic urethra. So this is where we're joined up with the urinary system, and we're now central. It's no longer bilateral. And then, of course, the membranous urethra, and then the penile urethra. So here is figure 7.1 from your text, showing the male anatomy. Starting with the urinary pathway, we have the ureters, which enter the bladder bilaterally. From the bladder, we have the prostatic urethra, and we can see the prostate here. So the prostatic urethra is the part of the urethra that travels through the prostate. And then we have the membranous urethra, and then finally we have the penile urethra. So now let's focus on the ejaculatory pathway. And in this pathway, we start with the epididymis. So now let's look at figure 7.2. This is figure 7.2 from your text, showing a testicle. So here we have the seminiferous tubules, which are inside the testicle. And this is where sperm is made. And the tubules then lead into the ret testis. So from the ret testis, the tubules will enter the head of the epididymis, and then go to the tail of the epididymis, and then finally the vas deferens. Going back to figure 7.1, we can see that the ductus deferens continues around the pubic symphysis. And then it continues posteriorly, remaining lateral to the bladder. Then the seminal vesicles will place their contents into their respective ductus or vas deferens. Then the ductus deferens will take all of the material that it has up to this point, and it will place it in the ejaculatory duct, which then enters the prostatic urethra. So at this point, we are no longer dealing with bilateral organs. We're no longer dealing with two vas deferens, two seminal vesicles, or two ejaculatory ducts. We're dealing simply with one prostatic urethra. So now the contents from both testicles are combined together in a single passageway from here on out. So from the prostatic urethra, we have the membranous urethra, which is joined by the bulbal urethral glands. And then finally, the path continues to the penile urethra. So now we're going to spend a little bit more time on each component of the ejaculatory pathway, starting with the seminiferous tubules. Now the seminiferous tubules are composed of Sertoli cells, which are stimulated by FSH. The Sertoli cells will then secrete inhibin B, MIF, or Müllerian inhibitory factor, and finally, androgen binding protein. The whole purpose of the Sertoli cell is to nourish the spermatozoa during spermatogenesis. Next in the seminiferous tubules are the Leydig cells. Now these are stimulated by LH, and they secrete testosterone. And finally, we have spermatogonia, which are stimulated by testosterone. So the seminiferous tubules as a whole are responsible for producing sperm. So here's figure 7.3 showing spermatogenesis occurring within the seminiferous tubule, which is this tubule right here. So here we have the Sertoli cells, which house the whole process of spermatogenesis within the seminiferous tubules. As mentioned in the previous slide, the Sertoli cells will provide nourishment for spermatogenesis, which you can see in these cells. We will come back to spermatogenesis later in this lecture. Now going back to the Sertoli cells, FSH will stimulate the Sertoli cell. Then the Sertoli cell will produce three things. The Müllerian inhibitory factor, or MIF, inhibin B, and androgen binding hormone. The Müllerian inhibitory factor is important in male differentiation, which is specifically in embryology. The androgen binding protein binds the testosterone produced by the Leydig cells effectively increasing the amount of testosterone that the germ cells, or developing spermatocytes, will experience. And finally, the Sertoli cells will release inhibin B. Inhibin B acts on the inhibin B receptors on the anterior pituitary, and this will cause the anterior pituitary to inhibit the release of FSH. So inhibin B acts as a negative feedback mechanism for the Sertoli cells. So now let's talk about the Leydig cells. Recall from figure 7.2 that the testicles are full of seminiferous tubules. Just outside the seminiferous tubules are Leydig cells, and they are stimulated by LH. And when they are stimulated, the Leydig cells will release testosterone, which go to the seminiferous tubules, as you can see here. Some students like to remember that Leydig cells produce testosterone by saying that ladies dig testosterone. The testosterone will then stimulate the germ cells within the seminiferous tubules, so they will undergo spermatogenesis. So now let's do a question to apply this. So let's say a male patient has defective Sertoli cells but functional Leydig cells. What would be the expected level of testosterone within the seminiferous tubules relative to normal? So we know that the Leydig cells are normal, so testosterone production should be normal. However, the Sertoli cells are dysfunctional. This means that the products of the Sertoli cells, including inhibin B and androgen binding protein, would be decreased. With decreased androgen binding protein, the seminiferous tubules will be unable to sufficiently retain testosterone. So going back to our question, the testosterone levels within the seminiferous tubules would be lower than normal. So now let's talk about spermatogenesis. As mentioned previously, spermatogenesis occurs within the seminiferous tubules, and it begins at puberty. And this is because GnRH begins to be released in a pulsatile fashion. The GnRH release will then act on the anterior pituitary to increase the release of LH and FSH. And when LH and FSH levels are high, there will be increased testosterone release from the Leydig cells and more androgen binding protein from the Sertoli cells, keeping the testosterone within the seminiferous tubules. Point being that the testosterone level has increased. And then spermatogenesis will occur. Now we start spermatogenesis with the germ cells spermatogonium, which are 2N and 2C. And these are present at birth. Now it's important to remember that N is ploidy, or the number of sets of chromosomes, and C is the number of chromatids. So once the spermatogonium are stimulated by testosterone, they will become primary spermatocytes. So they will be 2N still because there's still only two sets, the ploidy has not changed. However, each chromosome has developed a sister chromatid, so the C has doubled, so now it's 4C. And then meiosis 1 occurs, and then we will have secondary spermatocytes, so 1N and 2C. And everything has been cut in half because the cells have split after meiosis 1. So we have 1N instead of 2N, 2C instead of 4C. And then we have meiosis 2, which produces spermatids with 1N and 1C. So what split was the chromosomes with sister chromatids. So we just went from 2C to 1C. And then we have spermiogenesis. And this is where the spermatids will lose their cytoplasmic contents and gain an acrosome and form the mature spermatozoon, which remains 1N, 1C. As a side note, this whole process of spermatogenesis takes about 2 months to complete. So here's figure 7.3 again. So now we will focus on the spermatogonium. Here, 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 and here. We start with spermatogonium, which show two sets of chromosomes, one set from mom and one set from dad. So it would be 2N. As we have shown in this box, each parent has contributed 23 chromosomes for a total of 46. Now, how many sister chromatids are in the spermatogonium? Well, there's just two chromosomes and there are no sister chromatids, so we're just at 2C. Then at puberty, when pulsatile GnRH occurs, there will be increased LH and increased FSH. The LH will then go to stimulate the Leydig cells and they will release testosterone. And this will go to the seminiferous tubules. Meanwhile, the FSH stimulated the Sertoli cells to release androgen binding hormone, which binds up the testosterone, maintaining high levels of testosterone within the tubule. This testosterone will then stimulate the spermatogonium to begin spermatogenesis. The first step is to make the primary spermatocyte, which we've labeled in this box and shown right here. Now, all that has happened from the spermatogonium becoming a primary spermatocyte is that each chromosome has formed a sister chromatid. So now there are four chromatids and the same number of sets of chromosomes. So we remain at 2N, but we're now at 4C. And if you look inside the cell, you can see that each set of chromosomes now has a sister chromatid. So we've doubled the C. Now we see meiosis. If we're looking at this bottom image, we get meiosis 1. And meiosis 1 will cause the production of the secondary spermatocyte. So now the cell has undergone anaphase, and the pairs of chromosomes will separate. So each secondary spermatocyte will have one set of chromosomes, having only 23 chromosomes, each being composed of two sister chromatids. So the secondary spermatocyte is 1N, one set of chromosomes, and 2C, two chromatids. And this describes the secondary spermatocytes. It is very important to recognize that it is in the formation of the secondary spermatocyte that the X and Y chromosomes separate. So looking specifically at the secondary spermatocyte, let's assume that the yellow represents the Y chromosome and the X represents the set with the X chromosome. And just remember that meiosis 1 will separate these sets of chromosomes. So if anaphase of meiosis 1 goes wrong, these sex chromosomes may not separate as they should. So a secondary spermatocyte could end up with an X and a Y. Therefore, the final mature spermatozoan could have an X and a Y when combined with the ovum, leading to a XXY genotype. The XXY genotype would cause Klinefelter syndrome. Then the secondary spermatocyte will undergo meiosis 2 and form the spermatids, which you can see right here. During meiosis 2, the chromatids will separate. And you can see that here, where the chromatids are together and then they separate, together and separate. Therefore, each spermatid will have only one set of chromosomes, so they're still at 1N. That has not changed from the secondary spermatocyte. And the sister chromatids have separated, so it is 1C within the spermatids. Finally, the spermatids will undergo spermiogenesis and form the mature spermatozoan by losing the cytoplasmic contents and adding the acrosomal cap. The acrosome contains enzymes to break down the zona pellucida surrounding the ovum. Now let's do a question to apply this knowledge. So let's say a couple has been experiencing infertility, and upon analyzing the male's semen, the clinician identifies an immature sperm cell with 23 chromosomes, but without sister chromatids. At what stage in spermatogenesis is this cell likely in? So this particular cell has 23 chromosomes and does not have sister chromatids. So what is the ploidy, or what is the N? Well, it is haploid. There's only 23, so one set, which means it's 1N. And there are no sister chromatids, so what's the chromatid number? It's 1, so 1C. So this cell is 1N, 1C. Now, if we refer back to figure 7.3, as you can see, 1N, 1C could mean the spermatid, or it could be the mature spermatozoan with the acrosomal cap. In the question stem, it states that the cell is immature, which means it must be a spermatid, not the mature spermatozoan. So we're thinking that it's the spermatid. So now we have seen how the sperm is made, and that it's made within the seminiferous tubules, and explained how that process works. So now let's talk about how the sperm is transported and where it's located. So before ejaculation, the sperm resides in the seminiferous tubules and the vas deferens and the ejaculatory ducts. What this means is that a vasectomy, which only takes out a portion of the vas deferens, will not clear the sperm out of the seminiferous tubules or the ejaculatory ducts. And so this is where the sperm resides before any stimulation or ejaculation. And then when emission occurs, the sperm will go from the ejaculatory duct and enter the prostatic urethra. So then ejaculation is when the sperm travels from the prostatic urethra through the membranous and penile urethra. So here's figure 7.1 and 7.2 again. Now sperm is made in the seminiferous tubules, and then we'll go to the epididymis, including the head and the tail of the epididymis, and then to the vas deferens. So we can see the epididymis here on the left figure and the vas deferens going up, and we know that the sperm will also reside in the ejaculatory duct. Now, once emission occurs, sperm will then enter the prostatic urethra. Then ejaculation will take the sperm through the membranous and finally the penile urethra. Now, one form of birth control is for a male to have a vasectomy. So vas in the word vasectomy refers to the vas in the word vas deferens. So in the vasectomy, the clinician will make a midline incision and make a cut in the scrotum and then cut out a few centimeters of the vas deferens. So we'll say cut out this chunk right here. It makes sense why this would prevent conception. After all, you're removing the passageway for the sperm to exit the epididymis and the seminiferous tubules and to get to the ejaculation pathway. An important fact is that the semen, more importantly the sperm, will reside in the distal vas deferens and the ejaculatory ducts. So this whole region here. So semen and sperm will still be in these regions even after the intentional removal of this portion of the vas deferens. So patients who undergo bilateral vasectomy are cautioned to use alternative forms of birth control for several months after the vasectomy, because they could actually still conceive because of all the material that's within the vas deferens and the ejaculatory duct. So to review, prior to emission and ejaculation, the sperm will reside in the seminiferous tubules, the vas deferens, and the ejaculatory ducts. And then upon emission, sperm will enter the prostatic urethra, and then ejaculation, it will leave the prostatic urethra and go to the membranous urethra and the penile urethra. So now let's talk about the semen composition. So now the seminal vesicles will contribute 70% of the semen. Mainly, it contributes fructose, which is energy for the sperm, and then it creates an alkaline environment, a pH of between 7.2 and 7.8, so that it will neutralize the acidic vaginal tract. The prostate gland will contribute about 30%, and it will contribute proteolytic enzymes, and it will also contribute the PSA, the prostate-specific antigen, and this will liquefy the semen so the sperm can travel through it more easily. And then the bulbo urethral gland will contribute 1%, and this contributes alkaline secretions, which neutralize any remaining acid in the male urethra. And then finally, the testicles will produce the sperm, which take up about 4% of the semen. So now let's do a question to apply this. A man presents with mild discomfort deep in his groin. A digital rectal exam is performed, and bilateral blockage of the seminal vesicles is suspected. Upon semen analysis, what would be the suspected pH? So this question is basically asking, how would the pH be altered if the seminal vesicles fail to perform their function? Well, we know that normal semen pH is between 7.2 and 7.8, creating a slightly alkaline environment. We also know that the seminal vesicles contribute significantly to creating this alkaline environment. So with seminal vesicle dysfunction, we would expect the acidity of the semen to increase, which would lower the pH. So in answer to our question, we would expect the pH to be lower than normal, so less than 7.2. We might even suspect this patient to have difficulty conceiving during this time of abnormally acidic semen. So now let's talk about innervation of the male anatomy. So first we have somatic stimulation, which occurs via the pudendal nerve. And the pudendal nerve is a part of the sacral plexus, which is L4 to S4. And then there's parasympathetic stimulation, and this occurs via the pelvic nerve. And of course, parasympathetics in this region come from S2 to S4. And then nitric oxide is released, which causes guanylate cyclase stimulation to increase cyclic GMP production. And so this will then cause the smooth muscle to relax, specifically the corpus cavernosum. And so there will be arterial dilation within the corpus cavernosum, and the penis will fill with blood, and there will be erection. And then there will be sympathetic stimulation via the hypogastric nerve, which originates from T10 to L2. Again, T10 to L2 is the lower portion of the sympathetic part of the spinal cord, and this will cause emission. This is where the sperm enters the prostatic urethra. And then finally, there is stimulation of the pudendal nerve, L4 to S4, and this will cause ejaculation. Notice that the pudendal nerve is listed twice. So this whole innervation pathway for erection and ejaculation starts with the pudendal nerve being stimulated and then ends with ejaculation. So here's figure 7.4 showing the spinal cord levels and the innervation for erection and ejaculation. So as you can see here, we have the pudendal nerve, and when stimulated, it will send information to the L4 to S4 spinal cord region. Then the pelvic nerve will be stimulated. Again, this comes from the S2 to S4 spinal cord region. And this will send parasympathetic information to the penis, causing an erection. And it does this by first increasing the nitric oxide, which increases guanylate cyclase, then cyclic GMP, which then, of course, causes relaxation of the smooth muscle or the vessels within the corpus cavernosum. And when that occurs, there will be arterial dilation. And this will cause erection of the penis. Now, after the penis is erect, the hypogastric nerve, originating from T10 to L2, will then send sympathetic information, causing emission. As we mentioned earlier in this lecture, emission is when semen enters the prostatic urethra, getting ready to be ejaculated. Then the process comes full circle back to the pudendal nerve, which induces rhythmic contractions of the bulbal spongiosis and ischiocavernosus muscles, leading to ejaculation. So now let's talk about erectile dysfunction, or ED. Now, erectile dysfunction is defined by an inability to reliably obtain or maintain an erection. And there can be various causes for ED. It can be vascular, which means there's decreased blood flow. For example, in diabetes, hypertension, or smoking, this will decrease the blood flow. And if there's not enough blood flow to the penis, it will have a hard time becoming erect. ED can also be caused by neurological problems. For example, damage to the pelvic splanchnic nerves, for example, in a prostatectomy, or you can have damage to the hypogastric nerves, for example, in spinal cord injury, or pudendal nerve damage, which means there's no penile stimulation. Because recall that the pudendal nerve is responsible for the initial stimulation of the penis and finally the ejaculation portion. And then there can be psychological reasons, such as fear or stress. So what this can result in is erectile dysfunction, so trouble obtaining or maintaining an erection. However, their morning erections are still intact because males wake up in the morning and have an erection. And if males have a lot of fear and stress, they may not be able to obtain or maintain an erection when they need to or when they intend to. However, their morning erections, which are totally outside of their control, can still occur. And finally, there can be endocrine reasons, for example, low testosterone. And if a male has low testosterone, they can have low libido, which can cause erectile dysfunction. So much like in psychological causes, they can actually have erectile dysfunction, but their morning erections may still be intact. So to apply this knowledge, just think if you damage the appropriate spinal cord level, then you may lose the associated function, emission, stimulation, ejaculation, or erection, associated with that spinal cord level. For example, if we damage the T10 to L2 level, the hypogastric nerve would be unable to cause emission. Granted, if a patient had severe spinal cord damage in this region, or in any region of the spinal cord for that matter, he will likely present with far more debilitating problems causing erectile dysfunction to go unnoticed. But the same principle applies if you damage the L4 to S4 spinal cord region. There would be damage to the pudendal nerve. And the patient would be unable to be stimulated and they would not ejaculate. Also, this applies to the S2 to S4 parasympathetic region. The patient would be unable to obtain an erection. So these functions will not occur. In fact, a known potential complication from a prostatic surgery or prostatectomy is damage to the pelvic nerve. As mentioned in the previous slide, low blood flow to the penis can make it difficult to obtain or maintain an erection. This is essentially because the smooth muscle relaxation of the arterioles will not lead to dilation of the arterioles. Therefore, they cannot become filled with blood, and the corpus cavernosum will not dilate. Now, the cerebral hemisphere also plays a large role in this process. So here's the brain here. So if a person is under a lot of stress, they may have a hard time obtaining an erection. However, all of these steps will be fully intact. Therefore, the patient will still get morning erections even if they have psychological stress. So now let's talk briefly about drugs. If a patient is taking a phosphodiesterase inhibitor, it will prevent the cyclic GMP from breaking down. And this will cause there to be more cyclic GMP. If there's more cyclic GMP, there will be prolonged relaxation of the arterioles, causing the erection to last longer. Now, if a patient is taking norepinephrine, they will actually have increased smooth muscle contraction, so contraction of the arterioles, so there will be diminished dilation of the arterioles within the corpus cavernosum. So now let's do some questions to apply this. Now let's say that during a prostatectomy, the surgeon accidentally severs the pelvic nerve. The pudendal nerve remains fully functional. Now, following stimulation of his penis, what would be the level of cyclic GMP relative to a normal response? So this man has likely lost the parasympathetic function of his penis, but maintains somatic innervation. Therefore, the penis can still be stimulated but cannot obtain an erection. Under normal circumstances, parasympathetic stimulation of the penis would cause increased cyclic GMP within the corpus cavernosum. Now, with loss of the pelvic nerve, and therefore loss of parasympathetic function, cyclic GMP would be lower. So going back to the question, following stimulation of his penis, what would be the level of cyclic GMP relative to a normal response? Well, it would be lower than normal. Now, if we were to extend the question, we could ask this. Following the severing of his pelvic nerve, would emission and ejaculation be possible? Well, looking at the image, we can see that severing the pelvic nerve, right here, would not interfere with the functions of the pudendal nerve and the hypogastric nerve. So the man will still be able to be stimulated by the pudendal nerve. He will still be able to have emission via the hypogastric nerve, and he will be able to ejaculate via the pudendal nerve. So in answer to our question, would emission and ejaculation be possible with a dysfunctional pelvic nerve? The answer is yes. So now let's do one more question. Let's say a man presents with symptoms of erectile dysfunction. He claims that he has been very uninterested in sex recently, but continues to have morning erections. What is the likely cause of his erectile dysfunction? So he has morning erections, which should make you think that the erection pathway is fully functional. So this means that you are less concerned about blood flow to the corpus cavernosum or damage to a nerve. The remaining causes are decreased testosterone or psychological stress. In the question stem, the patient states that he has low libido because he has been very uninterested in sex recently. This should make you think that the patient may have low testosterone, resulting in low libido and consequently erectile dysfunction. And that concludes this section.